This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Good afternoon. Another day here on the WA Country Hour. I'm Kate Forrester. Well, before the news at 1 o'clock, you're going to hear from a 10-year-old girl who survived a bite from a deadly brown snake on her family's property in Queensland.
Dad was down at the yards just about to get a mob of cattle in, so he came up and drove us to the hospital, and then I got flown out by a helicopter, which was fine.
That is what you call a glass half full response there. So you'll hear how that 10-year-old is doing now and how she's also giving back to the rescue crew that helped her, raising thousands of dollars for them by selling two of her family's prized stud cattle. 6 past 12 here on the Country Hour. I'm Kate Forrester. It's lovely to be with you. Well, WA is now heading towards a record grain harvest this season. And there is growing concern about delivery delays and storage in some areas. Colette Newton is the CBH Geraldton General Manager, and she says some locations will inevitably close, but CBH is working around the clock to keep them open for as long as possible.
It's probably fair to say the yields have been a lot higher than anticipated and certainly a lot higher than the estimates that were put forward. We're probably about 35% out from the estimates. So that's quite a lot of grain. We had done some historical research and, you know, allowed for as much as possible. So we planned for a 4.5 million ton crop. And I'm looking now going, I think we're going to be sitting more around the 4.7 million ton crop. So, yeah. I think, you know, if you look at it in that context, this is why the estimates are vitally important for us in operations from a planning perspective. On Monday, we broke the zone record and we took 126,000 ton. So bearing in mind, if you put that in context, before the start of this season, the record for the Geraldton zone was 114. So we're now up at 126, and that was Monday this week. And we've lost a lot of firepower in fixed grids. So my message is CBH are doing an amazing job. The team's out on sites and everybody involved in the planning. We are doing a very good job. And I know people are queued up and it's not our deal. But, yeah, if people sit back and actually think about what's been achieved, it's a good problem to have.
CBH Geraldton General Manager Colette Newton speaking to Joe Prendergast. Let's head around in a bit of a clockwise direction around the growing areas now. And all sorts of records have been broken in the southeast, where CBH Esperance Port Zone Manager Paul Channon says they're now getting close to three-quarter time for their harvest.
Yep, so we were able to achieve a November shipping record, so over 419,000 tonnes. Also achieved site records at Lake King, Lake Varley and West River, and best ever seasons so far at Grass Patch, Mungallup, Shark Lake and Mount Madden.
Heading around now to the Albany port zone, which has had warm and drier conditions in the last week. CBH zone manager Will Piercy says it was actually their busiest week.
Oh, we had a huge day at Cranbrook. They received over 24,000 tonnes in a day. That's a huge effort for the team at Cranbrook. Had Pingaring and Ongrup also break their daily records. So that's about 9 sites this year so far breaking their daily records. So the majority of the grains coming in has been barley and wheat. Canola is starting to slow down now, and then more of the cereals are starting to come online.
Heading further north, conditions were good in the Kwinana South Zone too, and CBH Zone Manager Irving Carey says they're at the halfway mark, and right now things are as busy as ever.
We received 143,000 tonne per day, which is the highest for our zone. So we broke that record. And then yesterday, Kalingari, which is our northernmost site in our zone, they've broken their daily record yesterday, just over 11,000 tonnes for Kalingari. Wheat is the main one coming in, main commodity coming in at the moment. There's still quite a lot of barley as well. And then canola's finished. You know, so area 10 is done with their canola. Area 13 is done with their canola. And really, we're only running in canola area 11 and 12. They're still going with their canola programs. The quality overall, I would say, is good. We've had some good oat quality. Quinana South, we've always got some really good oats in Quinana South. So that's good as usual. Malt as well, some decent malt volumes coming in. And then everything else, I think, is, I would say, fair quality this year. The noodle wheat has been good. And then most of the wheat is coming in around your ASW9 range and above. We do have a lot of Australian or AWW as well, but just surprisingly, with such a high rainfall year, we're still getting quite a lot of AS9 and above. So I would say overall, it's been pretty fair quality this year.
And finishing off in the Kwinana North Port Zone, where CBH manager Alan Walker says last week was their biggest for the season, and so far the quality has been pretty good.
Yeah, we haven't had any issues with sprouted or falling numbers, which is great news. We've been testing all the stacks and everything's going very well at the moment. There has been some screenings issues in some places where the crops didn't finish off, but that's very isolated. So the quality's been very good. I think because we've had some 2 weeks of good harvesting weather and the big headers and big trucks. At the moment, we've been getting off really quick. Like I said, we've been getting 150,000 tonne days continuously, so it's been coming in really fast. So I think majority of people will finish before Christmas, but there would definitely be some spots in the north and east of the zone that are well into January. So we have six train sets that service the Kwinana zone, so we've been getting some grain out of the major sites to free up some room for more services. So that'll continue for the rest of harvest so we can keep some services and sites alive.
Kwinana North Zone General Manager Alan Walker. It's always good to, I guess, zoom out and see what's going on in different areas. And on the text line, do let me know today, with it being so frantic, how's your patience going right now? Is it wearing thin with how busy it seems to be? 0448 922 604 is the text line. 0448 922 604.
The WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Well, the year is not over yet, but Australia has already broken the record for most amount of beef exported in a calendar year. Australia has sold nearly 1.4 million tonnes of beef to customers around the world between January and November, which is actually up 15% year on year. Tim Jackson is from Meat and Livestock Australia, and he says demand for our beef is high internationally, especially in the United States.
US production has been falling this year, and so that's pushed up their import demand, and that's had an effect on beef markets globally. So their exports have gone down, and their imports have gone up. That's meant that the United States so far, like in this year so far, has been the biggest single market so far. Exports are up 17% year on year from last year to just over 400,000 tonnes. But it's also meant, you know, relatively less US beef for export, that there's a little bit more space for Australian beef in the market. So the US has been quite important in that sort of effect.
The 10% tariff introduced earlier in the year, which is now gone in the end. Did that 10% tariff mean anything?
Oh, it's still really difficult to say. Those supply dynamics are really powerful. And we've seen in the US really robust demand for beef, you know, even with pretty high pricing of American cattle and American beef, we've seen American beef demand at really, really high levels. In the context where, you know, their domestic production is short and demand is really high, those kind of dynamics have ended up being really important in terms of how the trades went. And so it's really hard to then break the tariff effect out from that.
If American consumers had balked at higher prices, it could have been a very different story, but they were willing to pay, and hence the beef kept flowing.
Yeah, they were willing to pay, and demand in the US has been really good. You know, Australia exports, in terms of red meat generally, over 100 markets. So while the US has been really important, it's not the only market. And we've seen quite strong demand right across our major market. We've seen strong growth in a lot of the smaller, kind of more emerging markets, big volumes across the board, really.
Exports into Greater China up 37%.
Yep, that's right. So up 37%, and the US is an exporter into China, and so we've been able to build some market share over them, both because of the US supply shortage and because of some kind of trade hiccups that have been going on there. But then,
well, you say hiccups, but it almost looks like a ban, really. They have not been able to export any beef to China this year.
Oh, look, we'll see how it goes with that. But I mean, the fact is that we've seen, you know, strong demand for beef, like Australian beef in China. And again, there are those kind of supply-demand dynamics, those big picture macro sorts of things. But then also, like, Australia's reputation in market is really strong.
So Australia is producing record amounts of beef. It's exporting record amounts of beef. And the slaughter numbers this year, Tim, have been massive. Is Australia chewing into its own herd?
On the last projections that we did, which came out in September, we forecast a kind of slight, like a marginal herd destocking. So the size of the herd coming down a little bit, but not particularly substantially. We've seen supply being, you know, really quite strong this year. Slaughter numbers have been, like you say, really quite high. Put that down to some parts of the country, pretty good seasons up to, you know, 5 years in a row. On the whole, because we had that really strong herd rebuild right around the country in, you know, 2020, 21, 22. And then kind of since then, we've actually not had bad seasons. We haven't had that big sell-off and that big liquidation. We're now saying that this kind of big mature herd, which is able to turn off really substantial volumes, like really big numbers of cattle, yeah, which is then flowing through to big numbers of production. And I think the other thing to note here, because we're talking about exports, which is ultimately about tons of beef, is that carcass weights have remained really high. And that's contributed then to the high production and export numbers.
Yes, as in it's actually not a record amount of cattle that have been killed this year, but what has been killed has produced a record amount of beef.
Yeah. And so, you know, there are a lot of different reasons for that. You know, on the one hand, like we've seen a bit of a change in the genetic profile of the herd, changes in management practices on farm, all those sorts of things which are contributing to heavier carcass weights which flow into production. And of course, you have to look at, you know, the feedlot sector. And so you can kind of see that in the sense that, you know, feedlot capacity has been rising, national capacity has been rising, turnoff has been rising, and that contributes to the carcass weights. But then that also means that grain-fed exports have been really strong this year.
Tim Jackson is the Global Supply Analyst for Meat and Livestock Australia, and he was speaking to Matt Brann. 17 past 12. Well, commercial fishers are concerned the state government's shutdown of demersal fishing off the WA coast from Cowbarry to Augusta will lead to overfishing of pelagic fish. So I'm talking about the small ones like sardines, anchovies and herring, and then larger species like southern bluefin tuna. Greg McDonald has fished in the Cowbarry and Abrolhos regions off the Midwest coast for well over 50 years, targeting demersal and pelagic fish. And the main pelagic species he is after is mackerel. He's worried there will be a transference of fishing pressure from demersal onto mackerel.
With the pelagic, it has been brought to attention over many years that the pressure from the amateurs was large. Every spot that I know, the amateurs know, when the fish come to about, sometimes the professional amateurs continuously day by day are out there fishing alongside me, trawling up and down. I don't condemn that, but I think the bag limit they've got is way too high. I think it should be brought back to one. As a normal, a trunk size mackerel that's head off and gutted is normally anything between 10 and 8 kilos to 7 kilos. And I think 7 kilos of fish at the lower number is plenty enough fish for an amateur for a day's catch.
And is that something you would urge government to consider given the anticipated transfer of pressure with demersals closed to pelagics, that the mackerel bag limit should be revisited?
Oh, totally, totally. And I feel that the government putting in this package of closing of the demersals has completely overlooked the domino effect that it's going to put on the pelagic fish.
Are you worried about the sustainability of the pelagic fish? Is that what you're saying there?
Oh, totally, totally. They've only just had a better run last year than they have done the couple of years before, with smaller fish coming through. And I feel that a knockdown effect on the fish is going to be a very long time again to build up.
Kalbarri fisher Greg McDonald speaking to Joe Prendergast. And Doug Gibson has been fishing off the northern WA coastline for over 30 years. He's a commercial trap fisherman with two vessels, one in the Pilbara Oceans and then one up in the Kimberley. Last week's changes to demersal fishing rules will mean the amount of days those vessels can spend on the water will be halved.
With these recent cuts, we've now got the equivalent of one full-time boat, and we'll be sending the other boat to Darwin to catch fish, which will hopefully be okay. But if that fails, then I'm not sure what we'll do after that.
So it is about a week on from the announcement about the changes. How are you faring now that you've had time to sort of process what it means for you and your business?
For our business individually, we're still able to catch fish. And I've had some of my customers suggesting to me that 30% will be a good starting point to lift the prices by. And that's unsolicited from our customers. So I think it's fair to say that you're going to see a very big jump in the price of fish in Western Australia because the supply's been cut for wild caught fish by two-thirds.
Can you just explain what kind of fish exactly do you catch up here in the north?
Yeah, we're tropical snappers and cod, so your emperors, your red emperor and your gold band snapper and your Rankin cod, and they're all trucked down to Perth and they form a reasonably good chunk of Perth's fresh fish supply into the restaurants and mostly into the higher-end fish shops where people, the specialist fish shops.
And so moving forward with these restrictions now in place, have you crunched the numbers as to how many kilos or tons of fish you normally catch and how many you'll be able to catch now?
Yeah, I've done a rough calculation on it. And, we're probably around half of our previous production. And I'm anticipating there's going to be very strong competition for that catch because there is just no fish around.
Could you just explain, I guess, because you're a trap fisherman, can you explain how that's different to trawling?
So with traps, they're like a big cray pot and you work 10 to 20 of them and you drop them on the bottom and the fish go in, first fish goes in to eat the bait and then the second fish goes in to eat the first fish and the third fish goes in to see what all the commotion's about and then you pull the trap up and take the fish out. I think one of the features of what we do is there's virtually nil bycatch. There's very, very little that gets thrown back into the water. So it's a very clean method of fishing versus trawling, which cops a lot of bad press, even though trawling is still probably the predominant method of catching fish for human consumption around the world.
And obviously you're not a trawl fisherman, but the main companies affected by this in the Pilbara who do trawling won't talk to us at the moment. But what are your thoughts on the trawler operators in the Pilbara that have essentially been booted out overnight? What are your thoughts on the position that leaves them in?
Oh, they're not happy and they've tried to deal with the issues that they've had, but you're fighting public opinion. Like, there's organisations in the background that are very, very anti-trawl. Trawling cops are a lot of bad press from environmental groups and it's just very hard for them to comply and they're up against a very strong lobby in that group.
Yeah, it's something that in her announcement about this ban, Minister Jackie Jarvis mentions dolphins and how no one likes dolphins getting in trawl nets. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
I think the minister's cherry picking her details because I was at the risk rating workshop last year for the trawl and the trap fishery and the minister's own department went in very hard arguing for the fishery and that the dolphin bycatch was okay. So the stock of the common bottlenose dolphin in the Indian Ocean is a very big stock. They're right out in the middle of the Indian Ocean in large groups. So, yeah, it's the minister's got public opinion on her side, but yeah, I think the majority of West Australians could probably start with their recycling bins and get what they put in them right. And when they've got that, they can move on to fisheries management.
Are you concerned about potentially there will be some extra pressure now in the north, you know, sort of north of Kalbarri, from those sort of keen fishermen who might decide to come looking further for demersal fish? Are you concerned about that?
Oh, absolutely. The recreational fishermen are very mobile and they'll go where they can catch fish. Recreational fishing, it's very strong in the Pilbara. I think you only need to go to any boat ramp across the Pilbara on a good day and look at the boats there. And I think the fundamentals of that fishing in the Pilbara are a little bit different, and a lot of people are going out recreational fishing for the day rather than to just nip out and catch fish and come home. And that presents problems because people do catch their bag limits very quickly. But when you've spent a lot of money to get 40, 50 miles offshore, which is where we're seeing those boats these days, then you don't just start the engine and go home when you've caught the bag limit in the first 10 minutes.
So if you could speak directly to Minister Jackie Jarvis, what would you say to her?
I think she's done the right thing calling the recreational fishing groups out on the West Coast. Like, they've treated the West Coast stock like a magic pudding for years and years, and that's been to the detriment of the commercial sector. So the commercial sector on the West Coast really did try and engage with government in good faith, and government always had their fingers crossed behind their backs, and so did the recreational lobby, because they knew that there weren't effective controls. And so it's been death by a thousand cuts for those guys, and I really feel for them. Look, in the north, it would have been nice if the minister had consulted more widely. The standard of what we call consultation now with the department is very poor. A lot of it's box ticking, and it's very, very difficult to communicate with people within DPIRD to actually have a proper co-management model, which is very different from how it was even 4 or 5 years ago. It's all just sort of come crashing down.
What do you think the solution is, I guess?
The minister needs to provide more funding to her department, to the science side of her department. Those guys are overworked and they're just not completing the science side of it on time. And there's also a bit of a trend within the department to ignore the science that they don't like and pick out the science they do like, which is not how it was. So the catch cry from the ministry is, oh, I have to follow the science. But there's science is a little bit more compromised than it used to be.
Commercial trap fisherman Doug Gibson, who operates across the Kimberley and Pilbara coast. He was speaking with Georgia Hargreaves. And on the text, Peter from Albany says, well, the lobster debacle, more residential college mess, Aboriginal Cultural Heritage Act, live export ban, firearms mega mess, and now the fishing disaster. More people saying the same thing. We warned everyone. Labor ministers do not serve stakeholders or the public. Thank you, Peter. You can send through your thoughts as well on 0448 922 604.
You're listening to the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
And just before we get to the news headlines at 12:30, I actually have a really good news update for you. Earlier in the week, you heard about Cogenup District High School in the Great Southern, which was at risk of closing its school farm after 6 months of struggling to find a farm manager. Well, I think you could call it a Christmas miracle, because they have just found someone to fill the role, which is so great. The school farm offers students from kindergarten to year 10 a chance to learn about agricultural tasks like cropping to shearing and also looking after livestock. It also delivers a Certificate 1 in Ag for Year 9 students and a Certificate 2 in Conservation and Environment Management for Year 10s. A spokesperson from the WA Department of Education says the school farm will operate as normal next year. So hopefully, fingers crossed, this means the program will be well and truly around for at least another 70 years. So great to hear that. It is 29 past 12, and Ali Colvin is in the studio with the headlines.
Thanks, Kate. WA's imprisonment rate has grown 5% over the last financial year to its highest level in at least the last decade. New figures from the Australian Bureau of Statistics show at the end of June nearly 8,500 West Australians were imprisoned, almost half identified as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, despite First Nations West Australians making up only about 3% of the state's population. Health insurer Bupa has been ordered to compensate customers whose claims it rejected over a five-year period. The federal court today upheld a $35 million fine brought by the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission for rejecting claims outright of customers who were actually covered in part under their policy. The Prime Minister says the United States has the right to make Australian visitors provide their social media history on arrival. The Trump administration is planning to order foreign tourists who do not need a visa, including Australians, to disclose their social media histories from the past 5 years before entering the country. Applicants would also need to provide phone numbers, email addresses and personal details of family members. Thanks, Kate. There'll be more news at 1.
Thank you so much, Ali. It is 29 away from 1. And between now and the news at 1 o'clock, we're actually going to get another update on the Bureau of Meteorology's website, which has actually made major changes to its new nearly $100 million website. The site, which launched back in November, was criticised, if you could remember that, because it was supposedly difficult to navigate and quite confusing. So they've completed its first major round of changes, and you'll hear all about that after I actually talk to the Bureau of Meteorology themselves. The duty forecaster today is Caroline Crowe. Now, Caroline, we've had some really serious fires in some areas of the state in the last few weeks, which I'm sure that means some people are a little bit nervous about the forecast of some very hot and windy conditions along with gusty thunderstorms. Is that still the prediction for the next couple of days and into the weekend? Oh, Caroline, have I got you there?
Hi, Kate. Yes, I'm here. Sorry, it was a bit patchy.
No, that's okay. I was just saying that there's going to be obviously some growers and people around the state quite nervous about the forecast of some very hot and windy conditions along with gusty thunderstorms. Is it still the prediction for the next few days and over the weekend?
Yeah, that's right, Kate, particularly through parts or the Southwest Land Division. But maybe we can start up in the north and then lead into the Southwest Land Division, because what we've got is a trough and it is going to deepen into the Southwest Land Division. So the thunderstorms that we're seeing through the northeastern part of the state, so the Kimberley, central and eastern parts of the Pilbara, getting into most parts of the interior, eastern parts of the Gascoyne and the Goldfields, are going to continue through pretty much the whole forecast period. In the Kimberley, we're seeing some falls getting up to 40 millimetres, and it does look as though those rainfall totals will continue through that Kimberley area over the coming coming week as well. So that's going to continue, whereas some of that moisture will be dragged a little bit south, but most of the thunderstorms as you progress further south will tend to be a little bit more little or less rainfall. But that area that I've described there, coming into Friday, thunderstorms continuing through that all area there, but getting right down into the Eucla as well. And then as we progress into Saturday and Sunday and Monday, we do see a southeasterly surge get pushed in those southeastern bits of the state, which will then push the thunderstorms back out of the Eucla and sort of push them a little bit further, sort of confined more to northern parts. Out of southern parts of the interior and out of eastern parts of the Goldfields, if that kind of makes sense. So generally, the Kimberley, the central and east Pilbara, Gascoyne, Goldfields, northern interior are going to be in thunderstorms potential the whole forecast period. They will extend further into the Pilbara and Gascoyne as well, and then coming into sort of southeastern parts and then contracting out. The thunderstorms could be pretty gusty as well in those areas for those northern and eastern parts. And the heat is gradually easing, still hot, getting to near 40 degrees up in some of those northern parts. And we will see that getting to the Gascoyne as well, or it has been getting into the Gascoyne. But that heat wave that we were seeing in the Pilbara and parts of the interior and those northern parts will gradually ease as we're getting a couple of degrees less than going from the mid-40s sort of more to the 40-degree mark.
Wow, so hot. Can you just reiterate for me again, how strong could those winds get in some areas?
Yeah, so for the northern and eastern parts, the winds, most of the fresher winds are probably going to start getting into the southwest land division as we progress into the weekend. Windy conditions through the goldfields and also getting into sort of the Eucla area, if we just can stick to sort of the northern and eastern parts as we speak at the moment, and getting up to 30 to 45 kilometres per hour. So that's for Friday, getting into the goldfields in those east-south-easterly winds. So what we've got is that trough pushing down, and we've got a high in the south, and it's squeezing the pressure gradient, which is causing those fresh winds. Similar conditions, or maybe just slightly less, for the goldfields coming into Saturday, and gradually slightly less on Sunday. And that's where we will see some of those winds getting pushed more into the southwest land division. So for northern and eastern parts, it's really probably more the goldfields and getting into the Eucla. As you progress further north, the trough is more broader and the winds will be a little bit lighter. Thunderstorm wise though, there is the chance of getting a pretty decent gust out of a thunderstorm, possibly even a severe gust out of a thunderstorm.
Thank you so much, Caroline.
Should we go to this? Do you want to speak a bit more about the Southwest Land Division?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Sorry. Thank you very much.
Sorry. So for the Southwest Land Division, we've got thunderstorms through central and eastern parts today. Those around the southeastern parts of that southeast coastal area will be more likely later in the day, if not overnight. And then coming into Friday, those thunderstorms in the southeast coastal district and just adjacent parts potentially continuing tomorrow morning. Could be a little bit of rainfall. So this is the area where could get a bit more rainfall out of the thunderstorms over the coming day, for coming into Friday. So 5 to 10 millimetres, possibly even a 20 millimetre fall out of these thunderstorms. Now, those ones will contract east gradually during the day, but then we'll see them with that trough developing through the Southwest Land Division, getting pushing into more northern parts of the Southwest Land Division as we go into Friday. And then on Saturday, thunderstorms through northern and central parts. So by Saturday, thunderstorms are expected to be sort of north of around Perth to Hyden area. They will be more generally dry thunderstorms though, and then they can extend pretty much through most parts of the Southwest Land Division, so west of around Ravensthorpe and all the way down to pretty much the south coast. And then on Monday, fairly similar as well, sort of through most parts of the Southwest Land Division, contracting a little bit further west though. So Southern Cross to around Hyde and towards Albany, west of that line and all the way down to the south coast. Now these thunderstorms could be gusty as well, particularly through the northern parts of the Southwest Land Division. And coming into Sunday, there is the possibility as a watch point, the thunderstorms could have maybe the odd thunderstorm, 5 mil, but there is the chance of getting heavy rainfall out of a thunderstorm coming into Sunday. And as we were speaking about the wind, so it's getting into the week, well, from tomorrow and continuing through the weekend, where we do have that hot temperatures getting right into the Southwest Land Division and those winds picking up as well. So Friday through to Sunday through the central wheat belt, getting into the central west at times, and even a little bit further south into parts of the Great Southern, you could see 30 to 45 kilometre per hour winds at times. And with the temperatures, potentially seeing some elevated fire danger ratings getting into those extremes as well. So there is the possibility of the extreme fire danger ratings. So for tomorrow, it does look as though that central wheat belt area potentially will be in extreme fire danger. So just a watch point as well, keeping up to date with that aspect.
Thank you, Caroline. And sorry for cutting you off. I was getting way too excited to hear about the rain with Richard Hudson.
All good, Kate.
Well, on that note, I think it's a good time to go to Richard Hudson. What's happening with the rain?
You're not the first to get excited about that, let me tell you, Kate.
Caroline Crowe.
The only region to get any was the Kimberley. Anything of significance. Fitzroy Crossing had 7, Fossil Downs 37, Lansdowne 14, Leopold Downs 29, Margaret River Airstrip 19, Mount Amherst 8, Mount Winifred 25, and then at Wingarna Gorge 46, but no rainfall recorded anywhere else in the state. Just quickly, due to the risk of fire, fair few places have have a total fire ban in place for today. So that's Karoo, Dalwallinu, Gemelling, Moora, Victoria Plains and Wongan Ballaju. If you need more details on what you can and can't do during a total fire ban, just search Emergency WA for the website or download the app, and it's all on the very front page there, all the details. And you also just need to check to see if there is a harvest and vehicle movement ban in place. And the Shire of Mingenew has just imposed a harvest ban. So obviously no movement of any vehicles, no harvesting in the Shire of Mingenew until further notice. And of course, if you want to know about the lifting of harvest bans, that's done through the Shire. Just make sure you're chatting on two-way, etc. While we're talking about bushfires, spare a thought for those in the West River area near Ravensthorpe, so close to the south coast of WA. They were battling another serious fire yesterday. At one stage, there was an emergency warning in place for locals. So this is less than 2 weeks after local farmer and deputy Ravensthorpe president Mark Moody died while trying to put a fire break on his property when a fire swept over his dozer. Well, Katanning farmer Peter Rundle is the member for Roe. Ravensthorpe's in his electorate. He says the farmers in that area have certainly had a very tiring fortnight, both physically and emotionally.
I think we've had a pretty rough time in the last few weeks. And obviously I did a condolence in Parliament for Mark Moody, who we lost in Ravensthorpe, a great community man. And I think certainly I'm pleased, as far as DFES and the like go, with their aerial support. And they've got aircraft based in Esperance now on a pretty permanent base through the summer. So I think that is something that's also come out of the Esperance fires, which are 10 years ago, Ivo. So most of those recommendations have now been picked up. But at the end of the day, this is where our farmers, our volunteers, do such a great job. They just come out there again when there's another fire and keep fighting. And we just need to make sure that we all support them as much as we can.
Deputy Leader of the Nationals WA and Member for Roe, Peter Rundle, he was speaking to Ivo De Silva. It is 19 away from one. Well, WA's Energy and Decarbonisation Minister Amber Jade Sanderson has held talks with a number of major South Korean companies this week, pushing for more investment. One of the companies was South Korean steel manufacturer POSCO, who is proposing a $4.4 billion green iron plant in Port Hedland. The CEO of the Australia-Korea Business Council, Liz Griffin, says even though Korea's investment in Australia has more than doubled since 2011, there's still a lot of room for growth.
So Australia and Korea are both middle powers. We have shared values and are like-minded democracies. Korea is Australia's third largest export market and fourth largest two-way trading partner. About 10 years ago, or just over 10 years ago, we signed a Korea-Australia Free Trade Agreement. And since then, two-way trade has more than doubled. It's also important because many Australians use Korean products in our everyday lives. So many of us have a Samsung phone, we might have an LG TV, we might drive a Hyundai or a Kia car, we might use Korean beauty products or watch Korean dramas on TV or listen to K-pop. So the Australia-Korea relationship is very significant. It's a long-standing relationship, and there's also a lot of untapped potential in the bilateral relationship.
Yeah, so what opportunities do you think there are in Australia for South Korean investors, particularly in the mining sector?
Yeah, sure. So there's a lot of opportunities which relate to energy. So Korea is a net importer of energy. It imports about 95% of its energy needs. So Australia and Korea have a lot of complementary economy, which gives way to significant opportunities in energy, critical minerals, but also other sectors such as defence and space, food and ag, financial services, education and tourism, and of course, Korean culture as well is playing a huge role in boosting the numbers of Australian tourists to Korea and also the number of students travelling to Korea to undertake study.
And here in the Pilbara over in WA, we have been hearing about the South Korean company POSCO, not only, their recent buying into lithium mines in the region, but also they're investing in green steel projects. How big of a player is POSCO? And what are some of the other major investors here?
POSCO is, as I mentioned before, Australia's single largest customer, and POSCO is one of the world's leading steel makers. So to make steel, you need coal and iron ore, and we have been a reliable and stable supplier for POSCO in providing it with iron ore and coal over a long period of time. It is a significant customer for Australia, and this was also evidenced when Prime Minister Anthony Albanese went to Korea recently for the APEC forum, and he went and visited the POSCO's Pohang Steelworks in the south of Korea, and that was really to demonstrate the significance of the Australia-POSCO relationship. But outside of POSCO, there are other Korean investors in Australia. Korea Zinc is a major investor in Australia. There's also investments from LG Energy Solutions, one of the leading Korean battery manufacturers. Hanwha Defence is one of the major defence companies in Korea, which are building armoured vehicles down in Geelong. Other investments from KOGAS in the gas sector, CJ Group for food and beef, and Samsung C&T are some other examples there.
Hmm. And so quite a bit of investment here. But you were saying earlier that there is quite a significant gap between our exports to Korea in terms of value and the dollar value of Korean investment into Australia. How big is that gap?
Yeah, sure. So Korea is one of our largest and most significant export markets. It's our third largest export market for Australia. But when you look at the investment statistics, there's a little bit of a mismatch. Korea is only our 19th largest foreign investor, and we think there's huge opportunity to narrow that gap and to encourage a lot more Korean investment into Australia. To do that, we must be offering a stable and predictable policy environment. As we all know, investors want certainty. So the more that we can communicate that to Korea, the more chance we do have of attracting that foreign investment into Australia. Some of the feedback that we get from Korean investors is around uncertainty around the time it takes for approvals and the complexity of the regulation here. But it's also important to note when looking at foreign investment and simply just doing business with Korea is the difference in the business culture between Korea and Australia. It's two very different ways of doing business. And Korean companies place a really strong emphasis on long-term, trust-based relationships.
CEO of Australia-Korea Business Council, Liz Griffin, speaking to Georgia Hargreaves. Well, 10-year-old Johanna Lamb was taking a break from her schoolwork, stepping into her cubby house, when a deadly brown snake struck out from beneath the floorboards, biting her left big toe at her property in Queensland. She survived thanks to her family's fast response and a helicopter rescue, but now she's giving back to her rescue crew, raising thousands of dollars by selling two of their prized stud cattle.
When I got bitten by a snake, I ran up to the schoolroom and Mum wasn't even out the door by the time I'd got there. And she took me inside and saw the snake bite, so she put a belt just under my knee and then wrapped it with bandages. Dad was down at the yards just about to get a mob of cattle in, so he come up and drove us to the hospital. And then I got thrown out by a helicopter, which was fun.
It was fun, was it?
Sort of.
What was everyone like who was helping you as well?
They were really nice and they were checking my eyes with flashlights just to see if the reaction, and they were checking my heartbeat to check if it was good. And every 5 to 10 minutes in the ICU hospital in Rockhampton, they would take some of my blood. When I was in emergency, I had one nurse and she said, "It'll be fine. I've been here for 20 years and I've seen so many snake bites and now only two have been envenomated and they've both been snake catchers. And then the bloods come in and it went from one nurse to five nurses and two doctors very quickly.
Wow. So what was it like then when everyone came into the room?
It was a little bit stressful. My toe was hurting like a lot because of the all the blood circulation getting cut off. So they had to put me in happy gas. I got my bed up to the emergency room and I think it was 3 days that I had to be in there. But for the first 36 hours, I couldn't get out of bed because my blood was so thin that if I got up, I could hemorrhage inside and they wouldn't be able to stop it.
Were you scared?
No, I was like, I looked okay on the outside, but in the inside, I was like, I really want to get out of bed.
Was it hard staying in bed for 3 days?
Yes.
Johanna is now in good spirits, but her father, Daniel Lamb, says the day is etched in his memory.
Just all those things run through your head. You know, you don't want to think about a 10-year-old kid having to plan. But anyway, we just did the best we could and got to Rocky in time to get the anti-venom in time and it all worked out. But yeah, those first half an hour really or hour was, a little bit traumatising.
The Lambs have organised the sale of two of their prized stud cows to raise money for Johanna's helicopter rescuers, as well as the local Theodore-based Brangus Youth Camp.
I've got a heifer and a steer that I have. My brothers are helping me break in and we're taking them to the Brangus Youth Camp to sell and donate that money to the helicopter people, mainly because they saved my life.
How much effort has gone into breaking them?
Lots. We get a stick and we have a little broken pillowcase on the end, so we flag them. We hose them off and blow them with our blower. We dance around like lunatics. We play really, really loud music just to get them calm to loud noises. I'm hoping to raise with the steer and the heifer up to $8,000 to $10,000 on each.
CAP Rescue's Rockhampton-based clinical lead, Dr. Tim Smith, said it was important to be cautious as snakes are more active at this time of year.
We have good first aid with early recognition and call for help and early anti-venom and critical care management, the prognosis can be good with full recovery. The problems you can get from a snake bite can include, unfortunately, bleeding to death. The other things it can do is cause issues with your nervous system and you actually can become paralysed and that can affect your breathing.
Dr. Smith also said anyone who is bitten by a snake should assume it is venomous.
When you are bitten by one, you need to move away from the snake and then you need to call for help and lay down. If you try and run for help or move away, you actually pump venom around your body, potentially. If you are prepared and have a pressure immobiliser bandage, you can wrap around the bite site. Every patient that's bitten by a snake, they must be taken to a hospital that has ICU-level care, a blood bank or pathology lab to do lots of blood tests and the ability to give anti-venom. However, if there's delayed treatment, then it can be still fatal and debilitating.
Dr. Smith added there's one thing he definitely doesn't want brought to the hospital.
If you get bitten by a snake, please don't bring it with you. When people bring snakes to the helicopter or to hospital, we also can't tell which snake it is. We use anti-venom for different snakes, but we can also give anti-venom for all the snakes, and that's usually what we'll do to be safe.
Some very good reminders there. CAP Rescue's Rockhampton-based clinical lead doctor, Tim Smith, ending that report by Claudia Sullivan. Well, the Bureau of Meteorology has unveiled further changes to its controversial new website that cost nearly $100 million to build. So far, they've had 70 million site visits and over 400,000 items of community feedback. Senior meteorologist Andrea Peace says the Bureau has been listening closely to the public to improve their overall experience.
We've made some changes to the weather map, the radar page, also some other information around forecast or observed temperatures, make some performance improvements and some new features for the community.
A lot of feedback by the looks of it. 400,000 items, is that right?
Well, the last I heard was around 300, but yeah, could very well be around 400,000. And, you know, that's fantastic. That is the community speaking and really helping shape the website that they, you know, that they use all the time. So it's great that people are continuing to send in their feedback. And it's helping us prioritize what it is we do next with the website. So we heard a lot of people put in feedback that they were having some trouble with the little indicator where they were on the radar. So now when you log on to the weather map page, which has the radar in it, it was, I think, a black colour. Now it's a nice red colour, so you can really see very clearly where you are. Another thing that we've done is really tried to make the radar and weather page a bit easier to customize. So now when you click on the information around the layers, what you actually want to display on the weather page, you can actually, on the left-hand side now, we've got all of the weather-related information and then the map settings, which used to be on the left-hand side and now on the right-hand side. People were telling us that they weren't really using those so much. What they wanted right where they are sort of looking on the left-hand side is all their weather information. So they wanted to be able to click the rain, they wanted to be able to click wind, they wanted to be able to click the forecast, and that's where you can also select whether you look at the radar and reflectivity or rain rate.
So are more changes on the way?
Absolutely. So some of the changes that I've talked about today were actually to do with feedback that had come in during the beta phase of the new website, so before we actually launched it, and then some of them are in direct feedback to what we've been hearing since the website has launched. So basically every piece of feedback we're getting, it's going into sort of, I guess, a list with themes. The themes that are coming through really strongly are helping us prioritise what we do next. One of the big things that we did do this time around was because we know everyone loves the radar, and some people were having a little bit of challenge kind of finding it if you hadn't put in a particular location. So we now have a button right on the very front page that you can just click on, just right under Discover Your Weather, which you can't miss. Continual improvement. We'll keep everyone updated as new changes do occur.
Senior meteorologist Andrea Peace from the Bureau of Meteorology speaking to Warwick Long.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. A retrial has been ordered for former Jetstar pilot Greg Lynn over the alleged murder of Carol Clay, his conviction being set aside. The US plans to check Australian visitors' social media accounts under new immigration rules. A large oil tanker off the coast of Venezuela has been seized by the US military. And 20 years on from the Cronulla riots, and the beach now has a whole new generation of multicultural lifeguards. Those stories and more. Join me for The World Today.
3 minutes to one. Only wiener cattle sold at Mount Barker this morning. Tracy Kilner, I hear it was quite a big sale. Could you please run me through the prices?
Numbers doubled for a total yarding of 1,681 head at the Mount Barker wiener sale. Quality and prices fluctuated, with feeder buyers chasing the heavyweights and restockers not as buoyant as last sale. Heavy steer calves reached a top of 468 cents, while all categories of heifers eased with demand. The extra heavyweight wiener steers weighing over 380 kilos sold from 380 to 464 cents, while heavyweights over 330 kilos made 414 to 468 cents a kilo. Lightweights from 280 kilos made 440 to 536 cents, and weights under 280 kilos sold from 418 up to 550 cents a kilo. The extra heavyweight wiener heifers weighing over 380 kilos made 326 to 352 cents. Heavyweights weighing over 330 kilos sold from 348 to 418 cents. Lighter weight heifers over 280 kilos returned 312 to 370 cents, and under 280 kilo heifers made 326 to 352 cents a kilo. The little bullies sold to feeder buyers for 265 to 332 cents, quality dependent. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Tracy. And tomorrow, Mount Barker will host a trade cattle sale. So Tracy will summarise those prices on tomorrow's show. And Richard Hudson is back with me because a bushfire warning has just been issued.
Yeah, this is pretty close to Perth. So it's at an emergency warning level in place for the city of Canning, city of Gosnells and city of Kalamunda. So around the area of Welshpool Road East, Tonkin Highway, Kenwick Road, Brixton Street, Roe Highway. So this is in the suburbs of Kenwick, Wattle Grove, Maddington and Beckenham. Obviously a serious fire. If you know someone in that area or if you're in that area, then you are in danger and you need to act immediately to survive. There is a threat to lives and homes. Aerial support has been sent to assist the ground crews. That bushfire is moving in an easterly direction. And if you need more details, if you're driving up towards Perth, for instance, go to the Emergency WA website or the Emergency WA app and keep listening to Joe Trilling on ABC Perth on digital or ABC 720 on analogue radio.
Thank you, Richard. Stay safe out there. It is 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.